Welcome to another episode of the Indie Founder Podcast. My name is Tiago and today I have for you an interview. I often interview other indie makers, people that have built companies, and I love to talk with them because I always learn something new. In today's interview, my guest is Elston, the founder of Tiny Host. Before we get into this, let me just ask you one favor. If you are on your phone, on your laptop, just take a few seconds to give a good review to this podcast. You can do it on Spotify, you can do it on Apple Music, or normally in any platform. As you're listening to this, just scroll to the review page and give us a 5-star review. This really helps us grow the Indie Founder Podcast. Now, without any further ado, here's Elston. Elston, welcome to the Indie Founder Podcast. How are you?
Doing well, Tiago. Great to be on the first Portuguese podcast I think I've ever been on.
Oh, is it? Nice. Yeah. It's a completely different experience, I have to tell you. now you'll see, you know, what it's real all about. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so Elston, we met in person. I guess we met through Twitter, but in person here in Lisbon. Because actually, do you live here part-time, or now you are in London, or you lived here, like, what is the status now?
I'm in between both. So I try to spend maybe 4 or 5 months a year in Lisbon, rest in London, and maybe travel a little bit. I'm in a process of exploring kind of where I want to spend a lot of, you know, my next stage of life. So yeah, okay. I'm between the both right now, and yeah, I get the best of both worlds, which helps a lot.
Yeah, and it's not too far as well, right?
So it's super, super fast and easy to get there, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, we met there, and you are also a full-time indie maker now, the founder of Tiny Host. And yeah, today I want to explore multiple topics. We're just discussing a little bit, but basically, I want to explore the topic of validating ideas, how you do that, what is your advice for indie makers starting out, and as well, the second stage, which is how to grow a business. So once you validate the idea, once you see that the idea actually has legs and can pay the bills, how to scale it and what changes, because I know that these are two different phases. So yeah, that's kind of the agenda for today's episode. What do you think? Is that fine?
Cool. Sounds great. Let's dive in.
Cool. So first, I would like to ask you for a quick snapshot of your life, like a quick background, if you will. Tell me, yeah, what is your background? Like, you're a developer, are you more in the marketing side? And yeah, kind of the story before you became a full-time indie maker.
Yeah, I mean, I can actually go way back to just being a teenager. And there's a really interesting full circle moment, which I'll explain. But like, when I was a teenager and, you know, just the internet wasn't dial-up, I was really interested in just, you know, playing around with web design, getting, you know, websites online, creating websites for people just as a freelancer. I didn't really know how to code, but I was had a really, you know, good interest in designing like HTML, CSS. And then I decided to, like, you know, learn more about that and study computer science. Went down a route, got my first job, you know, in a very big company, a big bank. Everyone would have thought, did think that it was an amazing job, like successful, done, you know, everything done right through university and school. You should be really happy. But I hated it, honestly. Like, I did the internship there and I just hated the corporate experience. I saw what my life would be 5-10 years down the line, and it was like the guy in the next chair, just with a little more money. And I was just like, I did all of this hard work literally to just be here, and this is going to be the rest of like the next 20 years of my career. And at that point, I actually realized that, okay, I want to do my own thing. I need to be my own boss. I didn't really set out to be an entrepreneur as such, right? But I realized like I had lots of different skills, like design or like engineering, like a bit of marketing and like management. And at a big company, you're basically pigeonholed, because you need to be very specialized, as hundreds of thousands of people, and everyone needs to do that specific thing really, really well. And so I realized that I need to be more in the startup world. So I started, you know, diving into that, had some side projects, went through the typical, try to get YC money, ran a company with a friend of mine, which was like my first full-time like jump into that world, where we built software for law firms, hired a team of like, you know, 15 engineers in India. So that was a really cool deep dive. But learned like, get one of the standard lessons really early on is that like you need to do more than just build something. And so it never took off. Went back into the corporate world and kind of just reset at that point, where I was like, I want to just do something by myself now. And I was just so fed up of trying to pitch to people, trying to like jump and get into YC and all this kind of buzz. And I found Indie London, or Indie Hackers basically, and joined a community here. Really, you know, fell in love with what these guys were doing, right? So they were just building small tools, independent, not trying to convince anyone to invest in them, just making money, and a lot of them making a lot of money. It wasn't just like, you know, a side job. People were living really good lives, paying, you know, double their you know, day job just doing this stuff.
Right.
And it was just the freedom that was there, like that. You didn't have to work for a VC, essentially, when you raise money. You could basically just build what you wanted to, how you wanted, and then turn it into whatever you wanted. You could keep it as a lifestyle business. You could go and raise money later on, or you could just, you know, be happy where it is, kind of thing. And that was really attractive, the flexibility. And then, yeah, so finally, I jumped into my last side project ever, as it seems so far, called Tiny Host. Tinyhost.com is now a main domain, and
basically, I didn't know you got the tinyhost.com already.
Yeah, we haven't moved over everything because of the headache, but we own tinyhost.com now, which is now easy for people to go into.
How much was it?
It was 7.5K USD, I think.
Wow.
So yeah,
how is this process actually to acquire the domain? So that I assume that this domain was owned by someone else.
This was actually on the market. So there are domains which are offline, basically, or you can't net on sale. But this was actually on GoDaddy available. And it had like a sticker price, basically. You could buy now for like $10,000, basically. And I was like, I don't think it's worth that much. But next on GoDaddy, if you ever see that, there's a number you can just pick up the phone and call, which a friend of mine gave me a tip. I just called it and said, I want to buy this, but this price is way too high. And within like 3 or 4 hours, like we closed the deal, and I was like, I got it down to like, 7.5 basically. And it was done the same day. So you
closed the deal by email, by phone? How was it?
By phone and then email, yeah. So I had one phone call with him, and then I just closed it with email, transferred the funds. So GoDaddy has like an escrow thing where you pay GoDaddy, and GoDaddy transfers it over, and they hold the domain and everything. But GoDaddy have a broker service. You can actually go to them and say, buy me that domain. I want to buy that domain, and they'll go do the research and come back to you with the prices of that domain, basically, and then you negotiate through them. So you can go after any domain, but some of them are crazy high. They do charge a one-off fee. I think it's like $100 or something to broker they may charge a transaction fee on the other side or something. I don't know what it is, but if the domain is already listed on GoDaddy, they don't charge that fee. So I got charged nothing for this transaction.
Okay.
Which is
7K.
Cool.
It's still a lot though. Why did you decide to go for the .com?
The .com, I think, is just a more reputable domain name. It still is. Like it's the old, like, you know, old houses are the best kind of strategy, right? Analogy.
But for SEO?
For SEO, there is rumors that GoogleTreats.com is better, but we don't do any SEO around that domain right now. The biggest reason, to be honest, was more word of mouth, in the sense that multiple people thought we were tinyhost.com. And one of my friends from Indie London was like, dude, why do you not own tinyhost.com? I just went to it and it's not there. And that was like the final stone. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go buy it. It's just easier to say than like what the old domain, which is tiny.host with two eyes. We own multiple domains. We own tiny.com with two eyes. We own tiny.host with one eye. Now we own tinyhost.com, spelled correctly. But like when I'm having a conversation,
two eyes are tough.
The story behind that is I cheaped out when I started this as a side project. I didn't realize what it would be. And the one eye one was like $300 a year. And the two eyes was like $10, and I was like, I'm just gonna buy the $10 one. Someone actually bought the one with one eye and then tried to sell it back to me for like $20,000, and I just ignored him, and eventually I got it from him for like $2,000 in the end. But the renewal fee is ridiculous on that. It's like $300 a year for some reason. Wow. I don't know why. But that's the last time I buy a spell and buy a domain wrong, because now I've got this massive migration to do at some point. But it's just easier to say. If I'm having a conversation with someone, I can just say tinyhost.com. It just redirects anyway.
I always go to .com, to be honest. Yeah. I always try to find something that would be .com. Just,
exactly.
Yeah, people just assume it's .com, I think.
So, yeah, there is a lot of value for getting things as .coms. And so TinyHost essentially is the simplest way to share your work online. It's a drag-and-drop web hosting tool. So we've taken the complex world of web hosting and made it accessible to low technical or non-technical people, so you can host everything, a lot of things right now. So we've just, originally it was HTML and CSS and web stuff, now it's PDFs, but we've also just expanded to PowerPoint presentations, Excel files, images, MP3s, like Canon RAW formats, and so for mm-hmm. photographers and that kind of stuff, right. And we're going to grow that list. So we're trying to be the best way to share work online.
Yeah. So just to, is as simple as for me, let's say I have a PDF, mm-hmm. I drag and drop the PDF to TinyHost, and then I'll have like a domain and a URL saying, okay, this is Tiago's PDF. And then I can just send it to anyone.
Send it to everyone. It's public. And you can customize the URL. And then we add stuff on top of it that's super helpful, right? So we have analytics, you can pass or protect it. You can add email capture. You can embed it. You can add a QR code.
I mean, now it's a very mature product, right? But so what was the MVP? What was like the first thing?
The MVP was super, super MVP. You couldn't pay. You couldn't log in. It took about 10 minutes for your file to go live. And I built that maybe in about, I don't know, 2-3 weeks part-time. And I was like, I'm done building. I just want people to use it. I was just burnt from like the old stuff. I posted it to Reddit, and I was like, guys, what do you think? And it wasn't trying to sell it, say, check out my app, because you couldn't even pay for this. I was like, let's just use it. I want to see what you guys do it. And I got some really good feedback really early on. It was like, you can't take 10 minutes to deploy. It's too slow. And I want to like customize the URL. I want to add my custom domain. And I started to get a feel for like what the product could be, right, really early on. And it wasn't until like maybe 2-3 months we had a payment options, and it's evolved a lot actually since the first step, but the core of the product is still very similar. You can mm-hmm. still upload something and get a link for it in literally 20 seconds, 20-30 seconds max, and it's been a success. Like, we sell simplicity, which no one seems to do these days. Technology is getting more and more complex. People are clicking way too many buttons, have too many context switches, too many logins, and all this kind of stuff going on. But the simple things are really selling now, because people just mm-hmm. want to get something done without all the hassle of downloading Dropbox, signing up for a Google account, doing this, doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally, totally.
And it doesn't exist as much. It's hard to do well as well, based on like your business strategy and where you're going. But it sells. It sells really well.
Yeah. Being simple is complex.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a lot of things to unpack here. I really like the fact that you actually worked and raised money and then moved to the indie world. I think that's something that I would like to explore. But now let's get into the validating of the idea. You already kind of touched on that, on how you validated TinyHost. But so from my own perspective, this is my current theory, and I would like to get your opinion on this. Is what are you looking for when you're trying to validate an idea to see if the idea works or not? Is to basically have a kind of traction that you normally don't see, right? So indie makers, we have probably, I don't know, every week we have a new project, a new something that we are trying, or every month or whatever. And normally, within any of my projects, I release and I get like 10 people per day or like five people per day, like really, really low amount of people. But when we tried PodSqueeze, for instance, it was a completely different experience. Like the moment we released it, people were interested. There was like a different kind of traction. People were asking, like asking for features and giving feedback, and there was much more traffic. So is this what we're looking for when validating an idea? Is this the kind of traction, or what other signs do you look when validating something new?
Yeah, I mean, the key thing I think people don't misunderstand something is there's multiple ways to validate and build a business, right? One way is maybe good for someone, it's not great for others. So, for example, I did zero market research for Tiny Host. I just, and in fact, if I did market research, I probably wouldn't have picked the idea because I've been like, there's too much competition out there. I basically realized what I did is I scratched my own itch. I thought it was too complicated today to put something online. I knew how to do it through S3. And if you knew all the configs and everything, it was actually really quick and simple. And I did it for previous jobs. So it was part based on experience. And so I just wanted to automate that and give it to people and see what they would do. But I wouldn't say Tiny like was a rocket ship. And I said, it's like, I built it slow. It wasn't, it didn't really start picking up until we found a distribution channel and we figured out our positioning. And that was a point in my life where I wasn't in a rush. I wasn't full time. It was a side time project. And I was just playing around with the space, right? So that is an option when you are building a company. It doesn't need to be a rocket ship straight away. But what I did is I stuck to that space, right? And I basically navigated around. I realized that originally I was trying to position it for developers and it didn't work. So I repositioned it for non-technical people because I realized all the non-technical people really loved the product, right? And they didn't compare us to GitHub and Vercel and everything because they never knew how to do any of these. And so I navigated that through different through weeks and months, basically, and then found SEO and found a distribution channel that works, right? So, but yes, there are products now as well that rocket ship, and especially with AI and PodSqueeze and a few other friends in Lisbon, like they tried many products and one of them just started skyrocketing and they went double down on it. And that's also because of their background and they needed to get something off the ground very, very quickly, right?
Okay.
So with Tiny, it was that way. And in hindsight now, if I had to pick something, it was, really like the idea of build something that people search for. Like that's a very cool validation technique that people don't kind of, use.
But have you done it since then? Have you tried this?
I haven't built another project. No, but like the way we've, you know, doubled revenue and increased and grown Tiny has been through that technique essentially, right? So like I've looked at what people are searching for, like upload PDF, and now we rank number one for upload PDF.
And that that's also what we do with PodSqueeze. But you know what I find is it's very easy to look back and in retrospect come up with a theory on what it works. And people sometimes ask me like, hey, why did PodSqueeze work? And I look back and like, well, obviously it worked because it was AI. It was the right time. There was actually a problem in the market that we were solving. And now, funny enough, we are trying to replicate this. And we did that with Flarecut, which is this other product we're trying out.
Yeah.
And my co-founder, he was like coming up with a list. Okay, the product needs to have this in this market and needs to be viral, the viral component, everything. Then we both agreed, this will be a banger. You know, we are going to release this and we'll just count the money. And then we did that. We released it, nothing. So when I look back now, and often you see this also, I think a lot of founders make this mistake to think, okay, because we succeeded with this one, now we can actually replicate it. And we also have the same exact theory. Let's just go on Google and see what works, what people are searching for. And let's try it. And it will work. Might work still for Flarecut because now we're investing on SEO.
Yeah,
but we haven't seen that traction, and that's what I'm trying to understand. So, in your case, you said that you shared on Reddit and you got some traction, some feedback. Was this feedback, in your opinion, out of the ordinary? Was like more than you normally get with other kind of projects, or is just like one or two comments?
No, it was a lot of like feedback, a lot of comments. It wasn't like one or two comments. There were a lot of people that said, "This is really cool. Like, can you do this?" So. But I wouldn't say it was a rocket ship in the sense that it didn't go viral in any sense that now people look for, right? They're like, if it doesn't get 1,000 users in a week, then it's nothing kind of thing. And so it did take a lot of just messaging back and forth and, you know, getting people excited about it a bit more. But it didn't have nothing. But the other thing is, I didn't go by, I've never done the whole build like, you know, many small projects at once kind of thing. For me, I've always, that's just my personality. I like to give something, you know, everything and just be focused on that thing. And so I didn't validate many ideas when I built Tiny. I was mainly like thinking about different spaces, doing some very lightweight designs and trying to figure out what I would like to do for the next like project. And then I just launched this and then went in on it. And so I think Tiny grew very slowly for the first year, but throughout its journey, there were people just complimenting it, right?
Yeah.
And they weren't hundreds of thousands of people, and they weren't like three or four people, but there was a few hundred people around just complimenting it, right?
That's the thing. I'm also not looking for hundreds of thousands. I mean, that would be a completely out of this world scale. But yeah, hundreds of people, it's already... I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, I've tried so many projects that had like five people that like for me, hundreds of people for the first go is like, it's crazy, right? It's quite good.
And I mean, Reddit, I think, is a great place for that. Like we got our first 200 users, and this was free, of course, right? Like you couldn't even pay for it, but we got our first few hundred users just from Reddit. And in probably around, I don't know, 2-3 weeks kind of thing, we were kind of using it. Didn't really measure for retention or this kind of, just, I just wanted people to come and just have a go with it, right? And that was cool to see. And throughout the year, after we launched a product hunt here and there and started, you know, writing blog posts, we got people coming through here and there. But it wasn't until we found our distribution channel that I realized, okay, this is legit for business that I can invest in, right?
I'm curious about one thing. So you launched it, and you're saying, I think there was a tweet where you said you, for the first year, you only make $70 MRR.
Yeah.
Right. So that's nothing, right? Like for most people, they'll be okay, this product has no legs to go. And you, one thing that you said, and I find that very interesting, you pivot the market. And I'm curious to learn how you saw or witnessed that pivot, and what changed in terms of the metrics? Like were like people started paying? What was the shift that you said, whoa, wait, maybe this is the market that I need to target?
Yeah, and from the outside, it looks like it's magic and you just had this like vision and it just happened. But realistically, that strategy came from one of the, you know, building startups 101 principle, right? Speak to your users or just be interacting with them. And so whilst I wasn't on my on a phone or on calls with our users, every single site that was uploaded at that point, there wasn't a lot I was looking at, right? Every single support message was going through me. Every single comment was going through me. And so I had built up this like just vibe of the product, right? And there was two cohorts, right? There was part of it, which technical, who were just complaining and comparing me to Vercel and GitHub Pages and saying, you know, why have you built this? like, why am I paying for this? It's free. Like, where's the value? And then there's a completely different audience who are like, non-technical, willing to code students are like, this is amazing. I've launched this in like, you know, 10, 20 seconds. I didn't know how to do this before. And I was just like, forget those people, like literally the people complaining and the technical people. Let me just focus on the people that actually like it. And it was the same product, but it was just a different audience. And that was partly because of the way I marketed, right? I marketed on a very, very wide scale without any tunneling to like specific audience. Right. I basically said, look, world, everyone in the world, I want you to just use this. And then I want to figure out like what this should be. And then I kind of focused in one direction, right? Once I had some kind of data. And when we went more down specific product and market fits kind of thing, that's where we started to see. And so one of the biggest transition points was changing our headline from like, we're the simplest static host in the world to like, the simplest way to share and host your work online or host your web project online. And that really resonated with people, right? They understood that a bit more, or the right audience was there for that. And then in a weird way, now we have developers users, but they're not a big majority of it. But they came back essentially because they also realized that we're easier than GitHub Pages. Like it's actually quite complex on GitHub to get your stuff set up. Well, you're never going to do it in 20 seconds.
Do you remember any particular bad comment or annoying comment that you had?
And then read it. I think I put it up in a screenshot of one of the presentations I did. But it was just like, how do you like something like why have you built this? Like, this is basically GitHub Pages and it does it for free and stuff like that. And yeah, it's demoralizing, I think, at some point. But like, I inside knew you have to be smarter than that. It's like, if you make that comment, number one, you have to know Git, which is, you can't assume that. And number two, you need to be a developer, right?
Is that your reaction when you read such a comment? Or do you get demoralized and you were like, ah, fuck, man?
I didn't get demoralized. I guess I got a bit more, you get defensive, right? And you want to try to, stand your ground and tell people like why you exist. And to be honest, you're fighting a losing battle a lot of these times because you're trying to convince someone that is in a completely different audience that they should be in another audience. And it doesn't make sense. Like, you just need to explain that basically it's not for you. And I think Seth Godin says this a lot as a really big marketer. He says you have to say no to people, honestly. Like, it's your product is not for everybody. It will never be for everybody. Mm-hmm. You will have to just say, especially at the beginning, you just need to say no to people. Like, it's not for you, and that's why you don't get it. But it's for this person, and this person loves it. And that's, I think, a really interesting, totally. Just philosophy you need to lean on.
And what are the type of customers that actually love TinyHost? How would you describe
that? There were people that were literally using tools, for example, that exported to HTML. And so there were people using other website builders, no-code website builders, and then they exported from HTML and they wanted to put it on us. So Webflow became like a big audience at some point, still kind of is. But there's other kind of tools, like reporting tools and things, like very business-oriented, they export to HTML. And they need to basically... upload and share that to places, and we're the only people. There's a really interesting, another really good product we partner with, which I just stumbled upon, is called In5, and it's basically a plugin for InDesign. And so these are designers who use InDesign, Adobe InDesign, to design like interactive brochures and things, so they can click buttons, and it exports to HTML. And so before us, they had to actually know how to upload to an S3 bucket, set up an AWS account, and go through all those hoops. And we just stumbled upon this market that was a perfect fit because these guys had zip files and then nowhere to host. And we were the painkiller for them. We weren't a painkiller for the dev who knew how to use Git and GitHub Pages and Vercel.
Right.
But these guys were never going to go to GitHub Pages. They were never going to go to Vercel and S3. It was just too much for them. It was just a very annoying nuisance they wanted to get rid of, the concept of hosting. And that's where we really existed, right? So we found these guys and then we just focused on these guys because these are the guys that really liked us. They kind of treated us well, right? And they told people about it. And we did webinars with them. We partnered with them in blogs and this kind of stuff.
Okay.
And that's just one small like partnered product that was super powerful for us. And they loved it.
Okay. How did you find this... So you said that you're very involved, obviously, in the product, in the you're probably like Crisp or something, some chat functionality. So you started to realize, and correct me if I'm wrong, that some people didn't really understand the product, developers, and others, they really loved it. So what was your reasoning? You'd be like, okay, you tried to understand more from this type of group that loved the product and then tried to figure out where they were. Was that it?
Yeah, 100%. And so, like, I looked at every website, everything that was uploaded to Tiny, right? And I tried to essentially reverse engineer it. So, like, you look in the HTML and see sometimes they'd have, like, little tags to say this was created by In5 or this was created by this. You tried to figure out, like, how did you question them? Like, what tool did you use to create this kind of thing? Or where can I find more of you? And it's just figuring out these audiences and diving deep into that kind of thing. And so it's diving deep into... The green signals rather than the red signals. Luckily, we were fortunate to have green and red signals and we could choose. Some products just have red signals, right? And it's just like there's no way to go through. But we found this audience cohort of it that basically really liked it and had no other tool out there basically that basically could do this so easily and was positioned for them.
And how could you reach out to them? How did you get to them then?
To the partner product?
to that audience. So you got to that audience through this product.
So eventually, okay, I think I reached out to this product and they had their own marketing distribution. And I said, can we collaborate with you? So they put us on their blog. They put us on as like as a recommended host. Their support person, like, you know, recommends us when they say, where can we host? And that's a frequently asked question. And we gave a free account to them, to their support person who loves it. So she uses it for, you know, debugging their own internal tool issues. So building that relationship with them, we did a webinar and it took time. But essentially, we piggybacked on their product, right? And that's been our strategy as well. Even through SEO, we've piggybacked on partnering tools because I realized that what we are is the last mile solution in an entire workflow. So you use other things out there. You use, you know, Webflow, you use N5, whatever, to create your thing. But then there's always the piece missing, which is like putting it online. And that's where we fit in. Like, we fit in really, really well. And so I was never really at that point interested in building a website builder or anything else. I just wanted to focus on hosting because I thought it's a big space. And I wanted to keep it simple. I didn't want to write a lot of code. I just wanted to take this product and just make it work somehow. Mm. And that's the strategy that's just really worked, I think, for a while.
Piggybacking strategy, I've never heard of that. So that's basically partnerships.
Yeah, it's partnerships, essentially, yeah.
But okay, tell me more about that. Like, how do you organize them? What is a good partnership for you? How do you, like, give something and get something back? Because for me, especially when you're a small company, it feels that you have nothing to offer.
Yeah.
What would you offer in this?
And they, of course, and we were a way smaller audience than they had. And so, but what we'd offered them was a problem to their solution, right? Solution to their problem in a sense that their users had this problem and they were never going to go and build this, right? And we had the solution, the painkiller for them, but we didn't have the audience. So it was just a really good puzzle that fit. That's so we were so fortunate cool. in that position.
So basically you found, you were investigating the websites that people are hosting in your platform.
Yeah.
And then you figured out that they're using this N5 tag. I didn't even know that this product, but I'm not a designer, I guess. So you found this. Yeah. And you're like, wait, these people are using our tool, you know, TinyHost, to host this N5 products. Let me go directly to N5 and tell them, hey, tell me about that. Like, how did you reach out to them?
I reached out literally, I think I just cold emailed them. I think I did at some point. And this product, luckily, I think is an indie builder. And I wanted to go down the deep integration route where I said, look, can we just literally integrate into the product as a button so you can like technically just deploy? And that didn't work out because of the way we were pricing and it was just too complex essentially. But they said, hey, look, we can put you on our blog post, we can do a webinar. But there's different ways, right? So there's different strategies for partnership and you got to figure out like what and what people are willing for. At one complete end is like the deep technical integration. So you have a button, API integration, and that's amazing. At the least end, it's like blog posts, right? Can I just write a blog post on your blog that talks about us and how we collab, how our tools partner together? And then everything in between is like webinars.
Yeah, but people normally, they never accept that. I mean, I've tried it many times, right?
Like,
hey, can I write the blog post for you, a guest post? And normally they don't even answer, right? So
yeah.
What is your advice to actually get people to answer?
With those cases, was that a very high, tight integration, you think? Like, it made sense for those products to partner?
We tried this to... Maybe not.
We tried so many
of those that I don't even know, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that is it. And it goes into like what sales 101 is. Like, the people that are going to answer your cold emails are people like highly personalized sales outreach kind of strategies, right? Mm. Where you don't send hundreds of people emails. You send one person, you spend 1 hour making the best case study possible about why this makes sense. But like, we had a really good case study. We had literally, I don't know, 20, 30 people uploading from N5 to us. And we said, hey, look, we have a lot of people uploading here to you. We're not emailing you anyway. Really there was smart. Already like some relationship, whether we connected or not, and they would continue to use us. And so it was a case where the way we went about this wasn't like, let's look at partnerships and then let's figure out who's there. It's like we started with our data, then figured out who is a partner product with that, and then reached out with that case study and the evidence to say, look,
I've never thought of that. Yeah. Was that a one-time thing, or did you do it with other?
That was probably the easiest one we've done. I think other tools out there haven't been kind of as successful. I'm trying to think where we've had such a tight integration, but I think that worked a lot because the product was an indie product in some sense. It wasn't a big company in that kind of sense. So that was probably one of the better ones that did work. There are other ones like we failed at these as well. Like there's one called Brizzy Cloud, which we found people are uploading, but they never seem to really work. And I think it was mainly also from a point of we had what they lacked. Like some of these other integrations and tools, they kind of had very weak hosting solutions. And so mm-hmm. we knew that maybe it wouldn't work as well because they kind of were doing their own thing. But like these guys just didn't have a hosting solution. And so it just we filled a really good gap that it didn't have.
The integration you do is only through webinars and blog posts, or do you actually have like an API integration where people can just click?
We tried to offer that, but it just wasn't feasible technically, mainly because the way their plans and everything are structured.
Okay.
But it's just, webinars. And now it's just a partnership in a sense that we're on their FAQ for how do you upload your project, which is like,
okay,
it's just a very big necessity if you use that tool. You can't, if you just design That's something, crazy. You eventually need to put it out somewhere. Yeah.
That's crazy because as they grow, you grow.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I love this, the piggyback strategy. Yeah. No, you should kind of
figure out like what tools can you partner with, and they have to be at a similar size. Like we obviously, if you went to Adobe and said, hey, do you want to just add us? They're going to say no, obviously. But like this was kind of an indie product. So maybe more indie hackers need to collaborate more, right? And that's a good lesson.
Yeah.
Like these guys weren't traditional indie hackers, and they were, I don't think is on Twitter as much.
I think that's like, a problem with collaborations. We always try to go to the big ones.
Yeah,
because I don't know. We always think, maybe Amazon will want us. You know, maybe I can get a backlink from Google, whatever, like big companies. Whereas partnerships to work, you need to partnership with a company that is slightly bigger or slightly smaller than you, right? If it's much bigger, you might be lucky, but most likely they won't even bother to answer your emails, right?
It's with any relationship, like even if like a friend or other partner. You usually connect in a way where you're both in a similar state of mind, time frame in life, and all that kind of stuff, right? Like, and it's a relationship at the end of the day, right? With another company you're forming. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't go to Amazon starting off and saying, hey, do you want to connect with us? Very difficult.
I mean, in these days, I don't know, I feel that we always want big, but in the end, entrepreneurship and indie making is a game of patience, right? It takes time, right? It's been 3 years since you started Tiny House, right?
Yeah, so, nearly four now. I mean, and that's the indie scene, right? Like, if you want to go fast, go VC, but that comes with trade-offs. And so, indie takes patience; it takes time, but the momentum and the reward from it is better, I think, in the long term. It's a much more enjoyable journey out there, and better mm-hmm. luck of succeeding. Better rate of succeeding as well.
Yeah.
But people need to be patient for this thing.
But you know, I obviously, because I'm indie maker myself, I know that things take time. However, when you check X or Twitter, and you see like everyone getting crazy MRRs and everything going up, you think, what? Like, am I missing something? Like, and some, often you see like this guy just started and now he's making this. You know, people having tons of followers. And I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I get a bit demotivated with that. I look at those and I see, wow, like what am I missing? I mean, I'm happy for them, but what am I missing? Like, I think, okay, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm not just good for this. So I guess, is this something that bothers you?
Oh, of course. I think, but the thing I think we forget, and it's 100% true in every single like story you see that's like gone viral about someone making so much money, is you only see the tip of the iceberg, and people forget that. Like there was a recent guy that kind of blew up on Twitter, I think his name is Arab or something, And he blew up because he kind of got 10K MRR in like a week. And then there was like, I think Mark got involved and said, but you're not doing Indie Maker. And you dig deeper into that story. It's true. Like he made that, but he has a team. And I watched his YouTube video. He breaks down like what he's been doing. It was an hour long YouTube video. He was part of Build Space. He was building like for the past 3-4 years.
Easy Money is a scam. I think I remember that tweet. And then they were like, yeah, tomorrow I'll do a call or something. And then I thought maybe we'll sell me like some NFT. Like, to be honest, every time I see someone saying this kind of stuff, say like, yeah, you can become rich really fast. Like that's fake. That I don't believe that. It's not easy to make money. Even you might see people. And you know what bothers me? Sometimes I even feel bad because when I share like a milestone or an MRR grow, because for me, it's good for my personal audience because this always works. Always works. Every time I share something going up, people will be like, amazing. How did you do that? I gained a bunch of new followers, stuff like that. But that's annoying because in reality, when I'm on Twitter, I don't want to see that, right? Like, sure, I see that, I like it, but I want to see things that you share actually, where you actually kind of explain how you get things and show your failures and show your challenges and show whatever you learn. Yeah. Those are the things that are really helpful. But for some reason, the platform does not promote that.
Yeah, I think it's a social media problem in general. You look at Instagram, like Instagram versus reality, Twitter versus reality. Like people are not going to post. Twitter is a bit better than that. You have people posting like, you know, failures and maybe in the office. But it's people like good news more than bad news, I think. And it's just general. And it's annoying.
Yeah.
But that's why I like, you know, these conversations, podcasts, like communities, because people are not trying to get likes or following. It's just two humans like talking together and talking about things and trouble and successes, and that's where the real information exists as well.
Yeah. What about also like shit posting? I see often. Sometimes I even think Peter Levels does this. But funny enough, I was talking a little bit with him on Twitter, and he said like, "No, I don't believe I shit post. Like, I actually say what I think." But in reality, sometimes I see, even now what happened with Mark Liu, all this scandal and so on, and this gossip, these things also sell a lot. You know, there was a lot of people gaining a lot of followers just because they were shitposting Mark Liu and saying, "Hey, look at this, I found another bug, you should not do this," and so on. But it's a valid strategy. It's a valid growing strategy. So I always feel like, yeah, maybe I should shitpost more.
I think it again. There's multiple ways to grow an audience and build a business, and I think it really depends on you, right? And that's the main thing. Like, what are you comfortable with? Some people are just comfortable with shitposting and just like talking, you know, just rubbish all the time, or just like on Instagram, they're posting videos of on holiday and I don't know, with Ferraris and this kind of stuff. But some people aren't. Some people want to give a different type of audience, and yeah, I resonate more with the real stories and, you know, the real insights that you don't often get with shitposting, right? And Peter Levels does shitpost. I still remember, like, he posted something cleaning his air conditioning unit. Like,
oh yeah,
how the great it was. Like, and I don't know, I got like 200,000 views or whatever. And I was just like, why? Kind of thing. But
he was saying that Europe, they don't believe in air conditioning, and it's always so extreme. Like these opinions, and this, I mean, I don't know, but this Elon Musk does the same. I mean, Trump is a great example as well.
Yeah,
this kind of extreme opinions, simple opinions, opinions, they get tons of views because people understand it, right? Sure, the air conditioned culture in Europe, it's different than the US.
Yeah.
But it's not as simple as like Europeans don't like air condition and US Americans do. No, it's not that simple. But when you put it simple, people like, and that frustrates me so much.
I don't know if it kind of likes, but what more importantly, what it does is trigger people. And people are like capitalizing on this, which is really annoying to see. And Trump does this all the time now with presidential stuff. Like, it's, you know what pushes people's buttons, and you do it deliberately just to get the sensationalism out there.
But do you do it deliberately? Because what I'm trying to figure out is that maybe Levels, right? So Levels, it does one thing really well, which is seeing what people like and do more of that. And I guess he's been doing this for so long and Trump the same, right? I mean, I'm not comparing those them both, please, but I'm just saying, like, in general, like, when you just optimize to what people want, maybe just becomes part of you. So you're just like, oh, cool, people like the air conditioning topic. Yeah. Cool, let me just keep, and then you always talk in that way. I also wonder if he talks like this in this relationships and in more personal life.
Really?
He's also,
I don't know. I found some people's online personalities are very different in person as well. And I think that you put, it's all a, it's smoke and mirrors, right? It's showbiz at the end of the day, right? You pretend you're someone online, that's your personality, but in real life, you're someone else. That's what it is. People take social media too seriously sometimes, even I do. It's just people just write stuff, you don't have to listen to them. The difference is, like, it's just in your face now, like, and that's what triggers people. Like, no one would come to your room and say something then run away, but on Twitter it's like that. You're in your room, you see a tweet and you're like, what is this rubbish kind of thing? And you just, you know, you're kind of open to that more information now, which some views you don't agree in. People know, like, it's like BuzzFeed, right? It's clickbait. BuzzFeed was the start of that, like, clickbait kind of generation. And now people know that works in engagement, and they're just doubling down on that stuff. That's the way we are. That's the news cycles.
Totally. Let's go back to building and marketing. So we talked around validation, and now we need to speak about something that everyone was asking about, which is your SEO strategy. Recently, you have been also sharing that with us. I think what was, like, 150K clicks? I don't know. You just shared something.
Yeah, we get around 120,000 clicks from Google a month now.
120,000 just from Google. That's also happening, not to that scale, but for PodSqueeze, SEO has been a great, amazing strategy. We love it so much because it's very passive. I mean, yeah, it takes a while and it's hard work, but then it just works and keeps bringing it snowballs totally. So, yeah, I guess I want to get a quick SEO course from Elston. Like, what are the main things, the main things that someone that wants to grow their SEO, what should they do?
Number one, I think, is, like, invest in the right tool, right? Whether it's SEMrush or Ahrefs, like, it's expensive, but that's going to be, like, the tool that will guide you to good and bad SEO. And that'll tell you where the opportunities are, right? Like, it'll tell you, like, for example, this keyword, let's say, I don't know, maybe talking about trees, there's a specific type of trees that Google basically wants information for, but no one has content for. And it'll tell you that based on difficulty, right? If there's something, like a keyword that has low difficulty, it means that Google wants you to write content off it. And so that's number one, is finding the keyword opportunities. And also, like, I think the secret to our success is me finding the keyword opportunities that align really well with our product. And then number two is the content, right? And so it's about writing the right blog posts or creating landing pages that really target that keyword, right? And have search intent. So people are looking to upload PDFs. You create a landing page /upload PDF. And all it does is you click a button and it takes you to a place where you can upload a PDF, like, simple, that kind of stuff. But obviously we're not going to rank for, you know, some bigger terms, but that was a low opportunity. And then there's other technical stuff around it, which is, like, you know, backlinking, making sure you're connected from bigger domains, which is a bigger process, and optimization around it, right? So making sure that you're writing around the related keywords and repeating the keywords in the right way as well. There's some interesting things that work still, which is funny. Like, one of my friends from Indie London came to me and said, I've been having trouble with SEO. We create all these blog posts and landing pages, but it's not really ranking. And I said to him, well, basically, how often is that main keyword going in, distributing around your page? And he went back and literally just added the keyword in more common places. Not, like, overly the top, but it basically boosted his traffic, basically. And that was something that worked in, like, the 90s. It used to be called, like,
I'm always running. So surprised how dumb this Google algorithm is.
It still is. It's dated from that kind of thing. And backlinking is another thing, which I've told you about. Again, like, that was it's not as important as it used to be, but it's still an important thing where you need to get links from other websites because Google's algorithm is primarily based on that.
For us, it's extremely, it's really making a dent. And we can see we use Ahrefs, Backlink, like their tool to show your score. And we can really see the difference as we go up in our score, domain authority score. We get more traffic and we rank higher for those keywords. So and it's true. Like what we figure out is that the keywords, they must be on your H1 and the title of the of your landing page or blog
basic
post.
Basic things.
That is it's very basic, but it still works really really well. You said something really cool about the choosing the right tools. There are tons of them, right? So a few tools that we use, one that we really like is called SpyFu. I don't know if you know this one, but it allows you like to also import the data from your competitors, see what keywords they're using. That one is kind of cheap. It's quite good. And then there's a bunch of like free tools for keywords research. These like SEMrush though, and Ahrefs and so on, they're very, very expensive. So for someone starting out, do you really, like even if they're paying whatever, like $100, is this still, do you still recommend that? Or are they like,
I mean,
free options?
Yeah, I've tried some free options. They weren't great, honestly. I'm out of the tool game in a sense that I still only use Ahrefs. And I know we have an SEO person we work for that may use other stuff. But honestly, like just pay, they have a cheaper plan now, I think, which is like $20 a month, I think, where you can just get in. But like, You just pay $20 or $50 or even $100. Like I guarantee, if you're serious about SEO, pay $100, cancel straight away, and just spend that month using it and just see what comes out of it. Mm-hmm. Because I still think that's like the best tool out there. There's other tools which work on specific segments of SEO, but honestly, I don't use any of them. I use that, but I wouldn't say I'm like heavy on like SEO from a researcher perspective, using all the features of Ahrefs, that kind of stuff. I use it mainly for the data and just the volume of keywords I have. SEMrush is similar, but there's tons of features in with Ahrefs which I don't use. I know like an SEO freelancer would be better off using that kind of thing.
How do you, tell me about your process of finding keywords. So like what do you think of, like you go to the tool and you start typing PDF, like how do you come up with actually things to type?
I like the jobs to be done framework, and it's, you can Google
that
if you haven't heard of it. But it's effectively, it's about being creative with like keywords based on jobs that people want to get done. So upload PDF is a job that someone wants to get done. Upload HTML is a job someone is going to share. Share CV as a link is a job that someone wants to get done. And so it's a combination of actually looking at, again, I still look at what people are uploading and then going to Ahrefs and Googling and searching around that and then adding specific words, right? So with keyword opportunities, there's essentially different funnels, right? So there's top of funnel, which is like, I'm interested about HTML and CSS. So those are interesting keywords. And then there's bottom funnel, which is like, I need to upload my HTML right now. So I'm going to search upload HTML. So those are better opportunities than what is HTML.
Start with those.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So start with those. But doesn't mean you should ignore what is HTML. Like it's there as well. But it's the keyword. So it's the topic plus maybe like a verb around it, right? Which makes the intent together. And so we've recently noticed that like with technical stuff, you can rank for upload React app and you can also rank for deploy React app. And it's the same topic, but the verb has been slightly different, right? And so those are really interesting kind of things to think about as well when you're doing the opportunity.
Do you write different pages? Do you make different pages for these different words?
Because if you search those two words, two queries, you'll get different results on Google. So Google has a completely different set of results, actually, because Google thinks of them differently. And so we create different pages for that stuff, different blog posts around that. So
how important is the content that you write? Can you do it with AI?
For blog posts, I wouldn't say so. I mean, we tried it, and it's never worked. Well, we never got the quality we wanted. My goal for the blog has always been, there's a lot of crap stuff on Google out there, like a lot of just basic, like really boring stuff to read. And I think if you're really in a long-term investment, create things that are good to read and nice to read. When we tried it, AI wasn't, you know, as great. And probably like last year, I think we tried it. But we still write all of our articles by hand. And I think it shows, because like AI doesn't do the research it needs to really kind of create really good pages and blog posts. For landing pages, yes, you can use that and maybe edit it. You can use AI as a starting kind of zone, but like just relying completely on AI to spit out like hundreds of articles, you're just going to get this farm of just really low quality writing that people are going to click on and then go back on, right? And so our blog posts have always been storytelling, really engaging, really well researched stuff. Like AI is not really good at research at the moment in terms of like finding screenshots from other websites, use cases, examples, case studies for specific intents. And so you can see the difference in some of our blog posts, which are there because we have a dedicated writer. And you read like HubSpot. I want us to be a blog where people, you know, really enjoy reading it, right? Like come to us because it's a really good quality on it eventually. And so we start off with low quality writers and eventually we hire better and better writers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's not worth it to go on Fiverr and hire someone for $20 or $5. So.
And the one other thing about SEO is really that people seem to forget is like it's an 80-20 rule. Like you may put out maybe 100 blog posts or landing pages, but less than 5% of them are going to generate the traffic that are going to be needed for the entire, like out of the hundreds of landing pages of content we have, the 120K clicks comes from probably less than 20% of their pages, right? Probably even less than 10. And so you want those to be super quality.
Yeah.
And so one strategy is you hire someone low paying and you rewrite it later on to try and rank it once you see. But you whatever you put out that's like ranking highly, you want it to be good.
Really good. Yeah. Like my co-founder, João, is mostly more focused on that. And he has always trying to optimize our process. So now he has been playing around with Notebook LM. And he says that it's really good. It's the first tool that he thinks is really good to write articles because you can actually add a bunch of sources and so on.
That's cool.
But he's actually very picky with the content and so on. We also have a content writer, Adebayo is his name. And we have like a full, infrastructure around writing content, right? That's so cool. he always checks for the keywords, sends the articles to bio, he writes it, but it's like the full thing. And we're always trying to think, hey, can we do this with AI? And so far only Notebook LM has been close to actually delivering good results. Yeah. One thing that we noticed though is that we kind of ran out of keywords. So how often do you actually go back to your tool and search for new keywords?
Yeah, I mean, we've run out of keywords as well at different stages. I mean, we've only recently found a whole different set of pool of keywords, and that's looking at competitors and that kind of stuff. But like, you do come to a point where you run out of keywords, and the other thing you need to do is just the product needs to grow. And so that's why we've released all of these new file formats, because product's growing. And
new features means new keywords, right?
Yeah, new features, new keywords. If you now enable presentation hosting, there's loads of keywords that you can figure out from presentations. I can upload sales decks, upload pitch deck, upload course, upload corporate presentation, all these kind of things which are there.
So these are all things that people are searching for on Google? And you say I don't have this on my product yet. Let's build it and then let's get all of this traffic.
Yeah, so maybe there's keywords that you find that... And so like... We ran out of keywords really early on, and so but then I found upload PDF, and that then I built a PDF upload feature, right?
Yeah.
And then we grew that way, and we doubled revenue that way.
You and built so, or AI built, or Cursor built it?
Oh, this was precursor. This is like 2 years ago.
Was precursor? Yeah. Precursor to Cursor.
Precursor to Cursor 2 years ago. But yeah, now with Cursor, you can ship.
Now it's crazy. Do you use it?
Insane. I use it not a lot, but I use it here and there, mainly for like the very boring basic stuff. But if you don't use it, I mean, I think it's you're just running slower than you should be these days.
But again, it's so fast. It's like I'm building all of these new products, and it's mostly Cursor that is building it.
Yeah, but you still need a good developer and someone who knows what to do, right? It's the same thing with AI and writing. I think it's a tool, a very powerful tool that will help you get a lot of things done. But I still think like Cursor is not in a place where it can just build an app without you intervening at all. It also just gets things wrong. True. And so you need to know what is good and bad. Yeah.
I don't know for how long this will continue.
Yeah.
I don't know if it keeps developing like this eventually. I don't know also if I was in these companies that are building these AI models, I don't know actually what to think. Do you really want to fully automate it so that, or you just want it to be a tool that developers can use? So it's also a very interesting topic.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
So what about YouTube? So you recently started growing there. You just posted as well that you got accepted for the creators group, which I assume that you can monetize. Is that it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't expect a lot more than like $3 a year or something like that. But it was YouTube is good. It also crosses over with SEO. Again, it's way more high intent, which is really interesting in the sense that people who watch a video have way more report with you because they see your face, hopefully sometimes.
Right.
they have better,
they have more trust,
trust in the product, right? And once you've watched a video of like somebody doing something with that product, eventually you know you're going to be interested in trying it out yourself. But it's a long-term game. We've had videos I created like over a year ago, and they've taken like a year to rank essentially, and then suddenly it started rocketing like 10, 20, 30,000 kind of views.
What is the conversion? Do you measure that?
We don't measure that completely accurately. And it's hard sometimes. But we do know it's like the third, I think it's the third biggest referrer. It's basically the third biggest referrer for us kind of thing.
Referrer meaning that you see in your analytics that people are coming from YouTube directly to your website.
Yeah, from YouTube. To paid customers, I don't know exactly yet. Again, I think it's around third, but it's magnitudes less than SEO. But you don't know actually, exactly where it fits in.
Yeah, you know what? One thing that we do is really helpful. When people sign up for our tool, we ask them like, "Hey, where did you find us?"
We do that. Yeah.
Yeah, and we can see that actually YouTube is quite good. A lot of new accounts come from YouTube, and we don't have that many views. So we do shorts and we do some like videos. And even if the quality is not amazing, it still like converts and still brings some people.
Yeah. And I think best thing, like YouTube is difficult to do and people don't do the difficult stuff. Like you need to be on camera ideally. You need to record something, have a video and then put it out. Like you can write a blog post quite easily now with AI and stuff like that. I think it's changing as well again with AI avatars and stuff. Let's see how that plays out. But it's still quite difficult to do a YouTube video. But I think it comes down to also like in this world where people are just putting content and making stuff like so quickly, the things which are standing out is where people spend time, a lot of time investing in that one piece of content, right? So imagine writing a really, really good blog post about HTML, right? That blog post is going to do really well long term. If it's like a really good resource, then like you spending a half an hour just writing something about it. And if you do it with the right medium, so a blog post or YouTube is evergreen. So essentially like 2, 3, 4 years down the line, people will still find that blog post or that video about what you did and it will still be converting. Whereas if you do it on a Twitter or like, you know, TikTok, obviously not. But there are opportunities where you can stand out from all the noise by just creating high quality, long depth pieces. Because everyone is just going for the quick wins now. It's the whole world is moving that way with shit posting and everything out there. But creating like really, really like high quality content that's has depth and is an evergreen resource that is not just a trend can really help you stand out and get you customers for a very long time.
Yeah, same with YouTube. There's one difference thing though, which is in YouTube, people want to see more of the same. So if you like whatever trees, they'll be like, here's another video of a tree. And that's kind of a different way. I think on Google normally it's more like, I want to learn about this. Once I do, I don't want to know more about it. I already learned. What is the process to find out what kind of videos you want to do? Do you also use any tools to figure out what should be your next video?
YouTube is difficult, I think. For tools like the tooling system isn't as robust. I think YouTube has crossovers with SEO, so like you can find keywords that people are searching for and see if there's a YouTube video featured in there. And if there is, there's a good chance you should create a video on that. So if you search like how to share HTML online, there's a Google feature videos, right? And you just create a video on that. But typically, yeah. it's a process from like the top ranking like blog posts or articles, we'll then convert into a YouTube video. And so,
That's what you do. You find your
We find like top, like upload PDF. We create a video about how to upload a PDF, basically, right? Or how to share a PDF as a link. And so we have a content process, right? Where you maybe create a blog post first, or you create a landing page first, and you create a blog post, and you create a YouTube video from it, and you create a short from it. And so the same content is on lots of different kind of
interesting
verticals, basically. So you can
you start with the landing page. If it performs, you create a blog post.
Yeah.
If it performs, YouTube video. If it performs, short. Is that it?
And you can do short. Yeah, it's the whole content lifecycle, basically.
Interesting. So
that is like super powerful, and works. But also just searching on YouTube, like just search for the same things you were searching on Hrefs. Like, look, is there a video for it? How many videos rank for it? How popular is the video? How old is the video? Where the opportunities are? So those things are super helpful, I think, and just help you that way.
And what is the process of hiring someone? Like, what do you look for when you're hiring someone?
It's kind of like what we're looking through now. We got lucky in the sense that we managed to find somebody just on Twitter. Like, I put out a tweet saying looking for YouTube, and one guy DM'd me, and we hired him. But it's difficult to find one, I think. But it's also a high budget game in the sense that, like, a video is not going to cost you as much as it's going to cost you a lot more than a lot more, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It
requires a lot more. But you have to go out, and it depends what you're looking for. Like, the thing is, though, there are a lot of people on YouTube that are making no money, right? They've got a channel out there, a few hundred subs and videos. And if you can engage them, they're already making videos. You just say, can you just make the videos for me and I'll pay you? And you can get a lot of people that way. And so that's how, like, an Avid, for example, found people. They just went on YouTube and found people who or had channels there. They liked what they were doing. But basically...
And you tried that strategy yourself?
Yeah, I mean, we got a few people replying to us, but they're too expensive for now.
That's the thing. For us, the same. It's so expensive. Yeah. Like $500 one video, like $500 one video.
No,
that most likely will not perform.
The other strategy we're going for now is just training people, right? So like finding someone who's like, I don't know, a student who has time looking for some part-time money and interested in coding and just saying, hey, like, you know, buy yourself a camera and just film these stuff. And we give the topics and just helping them, like upskilling them that way. I think the generation below us, the younger generation, are way more just in tune with media and YouTube's and this kind of thing, right? And so they're very comfortable with it, but they don't know often that you can get paid for this stuff. All they're trying to do is get hundreds of subs on YouTube themselves. But actually, you can make a lot of money just doing this yourself by just making videos for other people. So that's what we're trying to explore right now.
Talking about money. How often do you think, or do you ever think that now, if you had like an injection of like $1 million or $2 million, you could just scale Tiny Host to a next level because you really understand what works, and you just have you don't mind paying for videos, you don't mind paying for more blog posts, more keywords, more features that you want to build.
Do you
ever consider that?
I mean, I don't consider it. I don't want to consider it from a point of like what it means to take on investment, because like what the expected return is on that kind of thing. But I have been considering, how do I just invest more in the business? But to be honest, we've been profitable in the sense that we can invest money where we need to. And there is a common misconception that just because you get money, you figure things out. And I think just throwing money at things doesn't necessarily equal scale. You have to throw money at the right things. Like, even if you you got, I don't know, $1 million and then you just spend it all on YouTube, like, you got to make sure there's the right YouTubers there. And often where you get, you're still gonna have to do the work on it, and you can get a lot of value from not spending that money because you just spend a lot less on the right type of YouTubers. And so I don't necessarily think just throwing money at it is going to help. Like, I don't know exactly where, if I had $500,000 right now, where we would spend it, because it'll be on people for sure, but then that would mean a whole different set of problems, right? Like we have to build a team and manage people and a hierarchy and that kind of stuff.
I mean, you could just hire top, you know, video creators. You don't need to wonder like, oh, it's too expensive. It's just like hire them.
Yeah, you could summon Celeste to manage them and figure it out. Like, and you have to then have a lead manager and do that kind of work, which is there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we're open to it, to be honest. Like, we've always never kind of completely shied away from that stuff. But the biggest blocker has always just been the effort required to raise, and also just the long-term commitment it means when you raise money. And so if someone came along and said, like, for example, we'd want to invest, and this is kind of the terms, we're not looking for, you know, VC levels of exits, and we're giving the option to do that stuff, would be more open to it. Mm-hmm. But when you're just caught up in the business and the days in and out, and I'm a solo founder, like with companies that raise, there's usually one founder literally pitching all day, basically, right? Trying to get money on it. It's a massive task. People think, like, because of money all over on TechCrunch, that it's easy to get. But it's not easy sometimes, right? And so there's hundreds of companies that have money and added money, and they haven't gone anywhere. So we do need to grow faster, 100%. And we're looking to how do we do that.
What is your goal? Like, I often think about this. Like, what is the company is 100% yours, right? So, why do you need to grow faster? Like, what is in your mind? Like, what do you want to become huge? Are you happy now? Like, what's
I think going it's a bit of I don't know what is. I have a figure in mind eventually that I just want to eventually hopefully sell for, but I think also like my next milestone and goal, which I'll be really just satisfied with, is 1 million ARR. And that's a really big goal that I want to get to with this.
Everyone wants that, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why. Why is that? Why is 1 million the goal?
It's a significant number, right? And then the next number.
Yeah, it's a strong number, right?
Yeah. The next number is like 1 mil MRR, which I know a friend of mine hit. And so those are the big numbers. But the thing people don't realize is that, like, and you talk about people that really are super ambitious and, you know, want to go down a certain route, is that it comes with a cost, right? Like, I know people making, you know, millions a month for the company, 200-person team, and, you know, they're just not as happy as they were when they were indie hacking. And you don't realize that until you're there. And so it comes with a cost. And it's like, what are you willing to put in? What are you willing to put up with? What are you willing your day job to be, right? Like, it's like, you're not going to be coding if you're a company that big with like more than 20-30 people, even more than like 4-5 people. You're going to be a manager and your whole job changes. And so are you comfortable with that? Are you able to make the sacrifices? And for me, it's always been like, let's go as far as I can until I hate my job and then figure it out, kind of thing. Let's just keep growing the company, because for me, it's also just, there's a massive opportunity here. There's a lot of people that need the tool, and I want it to be out there. A lot of people still haven't heard of us. And so it's more about that as well, just getting the product to as many people that need it.
So this goal that we put, like, 1 million, whatever, it's just kicking the ball forward to justify the fact that we just want to keep doing this.
And then
when people ask us, like, hey, why you come and whatever, hang out instead of working, I'm like, no. Because I haven't still reached 1 million.
There's the next goal. But I think everyone needs to have a stopping point or a number, a weight in their head where they're just like, you know, this is it and I'm just going to get here and then happy. Like, we've had acquisition offers, but I'm just like, I'm not interested right now in selling the company. But
there's a number. There's a number where you'd be happy to.
There is a number, I think. And it's a number where I think it makes sense. I think the value is there, and I've proven to myself that I can scale the company to this level, right?
Yeah. So that's also something that I'm interested in learning, which is, how did your mindset changed since you started finding this success and you started seeing that you are capable of doing things that maybe you thought you would never be able to do it?
That's why kicking the ball becomes like more fun, because you're like, oh, I've done this, now I can just kick it a bit more and kick it a bit more, and you realize that you unlock this whole like world of strategy on how you can actually make things grow and go big. And so I realized that you know, whatever you thought would work actually does work, and you should just do more of that. You just believe in yourself a bit more, right?
Yeah. So
previously, it was just like, I don't know if this will work. Let me try it. But then you look back and you're like, that decision where I added PDF hosting was a gut instinct based on just me snooping around kind of, you know, our data and our user base, and it doubled the business and it is huge. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to do more of my gut instincts as a founder. And it's the whole founder mode thing, and you knowing your business and you having the vision as well, that you just feel a bit more confident about where you want to go. I think.
Do you feel that this also affects your personal life? Do you also feel that confidence in decisions that are not business but are like personal,
like better confidence in personal decisions?
Yeah, you feel you're more capable of doing other things and taking decisions that before you thought that you couldn't do it.
To a degree, but it also has negative effects because you're successful in your business life, right? And when personal things don't go well, you're just like, I'm not having the same like result. And so you try to compare, but often it's not like, just take sports, for example, or whatever you do. Like, you're not going to be good at everything, but because you're good at one thing, you think you're invincible sometimes, right? And that frustrates you because you're not as good as, you know, as mm-hmm. other people. And it's because other people have invested more in that area.
Do you, when you see business people that then become, and going back to Trump or Elon Musk or Peter Levels even, and the success will eventually get to your head and you'll be like, okay, if I can do this, then I can run for president or I can do crazy things. I often think that's very dangerous because it's a weird line because it's, you need to be confident in yourself. You need to be confident in trusting your gut because this has proven to take you far, but there's a line. There's a point where you'll be like, dude, like chill. Like you are not Superman. How do you navigate that line of confidence, but still keeping an open mind and hearing others and stepping on the brakes?
Yeah, I know it's tough, and it's the hardest thing to navigate. Is, and I think it depends who you surround yourself with at the end of the day. Like, having a good group of people, Indie London or Indie Lisbon, basically, you can, you know, check you when you're right. And it's also about just living in the real world sometimes, right? Especially if you're a founder, we're very fortunate to be having, you know, the freedom, flexibility to go and travel. But really, speaking to friends who are not founders outside of tech, who are just living normal lives and just understanding like what their problems are and what's really going in their world, like it really puts things into perspective, right? And it makes sure that your problems that you see are not, you know, as big of problems sometimes with compared with other people who are less fortunate. And so these kind of things, and realizing that you don't have the answers to everything, because sometimes you just got to lean on the right people, or you're not in the, you're not even in the space. Like for politics, for example, I have a friend who's works for the government. I just don't know anything about that, but I think I do maybe from the outside. But when you dive into that and you realize what it really is like to be in the government, what they have to deal with, or everything that's they're going through, you realize, okay, number one, I don't think I enjoy that space. And number two, there's a lot that goes on that you don't know about, and you can't take your skills that you've learned in entrepreneurship and just apply it in everything in the world. There's a lot of crossover maybe with marketing, PR, and that kind of stuff, but you can't just run a country as if it's a company. It'll fall apart. And so, and you can't play,
I mean, I guess it depends on your political intentions, right? I mean,
to a degree, but like, there are
liberals are more, I mean, that's exactly what they say, that government should be a company, right?
But there are certain things, I think, that like are necessities, that like welfare systems, things that will fall apart if you do those kind of things as well. And so the US is a massive, you know, capitalistic country, but at the same time, it does have a lot of other things that are not government company related that it manages, right? Like, as a company, you don't need to worry about having an army or defense and your political game and this kind of stuff.
Well,
right,
it actually depends on the company. A lot of companies have security, right? Yeah, I mean, the companies that have oil rigs and stuff like that, they do have an army, not a huge army, but did you find that like your political inclinations have changed since you become indie maker?
To a degree, but I think it's still same pretty. I mean, the UK, I'm more in line with the UK stuff going on now, and I think here and there, but because you enter like different audiences, different groups of people, it has changed a little more. But I've tried to stay a bit more in line with, like, it's easy when you have access to capital, you start to be more one way than the other. But I've tried to just, especially with my circles and everybody, stay out of those circles as much as I can as well I'm in it. But yeah, there's definitely things mm-hmm. you start thinking about now. You have, yeah, you've unlocked the world in a different way, right?
Totally. And from my side, what I think is like, I'm more annoyed with taxes, for instance. That's something that I'm more like annoyed with. But at the same time, I look at these huge companies and I see, the bad things that they can also do to the world and how politics and power and money is so much intertwined. Yeah. And that annoys me as well. That's something that I didn't think too much about before. So yeah, it's like it's a weird mix.
No, 100%. Makes sense. I unfortunately have to leave very soon. Is there any kind of last questions
we want to go through? I think that's everything you did. But Elson, thank you very much for coming here to the Indie Founder Podcast. And it was a pleasure, and I wish you all the best for Tiny Host and your project.
Before the podcast, I said ask some original questions, and you definitely have, so appreciate it. And you're doing great stuff as well. Like you're, especially in Portugal, you're helping the community there. And I hope it's a lot more Portuguese indie hackers. Big fan of the country.
Yeah, thank you. I also hope so. There'll be more.